proceed further, let me briefly recapitulate what we have been doing so far. And so we have started with the Maxwell's theory as formulated by Maxwell in 1860, and then we supplemented the Lorentz force law here, so which provides the complete classical theory of electromagnetism and charged matter. And we have seen that as any median consequence of including the Maxwell's term, we can have actually the charge conservation simply comes from Maxwell's equations. It doesn't really tell you how the charges have to move. For that, you need this Lorentz force law. But it certainly provides some constraint to, you know, which has to be satisfied all the time. You've also seen Maxwell's triumph that actually, even in the absence of sources, we can have still non-trivial solutions for E and B, which are nothing else than electromagnetic waves. And they propagate at the speed of light. And actually, light is just some part of these electromagnetic waves. And so this is the box operator, which, as we will see, is a relativistic generalization of Nabla square operator. All right, and then we said, okay, we can actually go from E and B fields, from six quantities, to actually just four quantities, A and phi. And they can be introduced just as a mathematical convenience in classical theory, but they will actually live on their own in the quantum theory. And so this is the prescription how you do it. And so that automatically guarantees that I can solve the sourceless equations 2 and 4. And so that's certainly a good move to do. And moreover, there is still some residual, well, there's still some gauge freedom. And that allows you to impose at least one condition. If you are in vacuum, actually two, but a convenient choice of the gauge is the Lorentz gauge, which is written here. And so why is it convenient? Is that in this gauge, the remaining two equations, one and three, they just become basically the wave equations, and you can nicely solve them. So the solution of these things will be, of course, the solution of the homogeneous equation where the right-hand side is equal to zero, plus a special solution which can be found by the method of Green's functions, as we discussed yesterday. And so then, well, if you do that, you find the Green's function. You find, at least if I'm not wrong, you find both solutions. You find retarded and advanced solutions. And then you say, advanced solutions I don't want. But the retarded Green function is simply a delta function of the distance between the source and the observer and their times. And so this is your delta. And then this is 1 over r. And so if you integrate over these Green function, over the sources, that's how you get your potential. And of course, in this case, because this is just a delta function, I can actually do the integration over time. And so if you do the integration over time, you just plug everywhere that time t prime is just r minus t. And so that's done here. And so this is the solution for the potential. But of course, the equation for the vector potential is the same. And so that's why you have exactly the same solution here. So these solutions are called retarded potentials because we used the retarded Green function here. OK, so why they are also retarded potentials is that basically you have to have a source which is in the past light cone of your observer. So if you have time t here and the distance r, and you have the sources, it sort of swipes some trajectory in this TR plane. So they will only contribute to your field at point T and R of the observer if actually they lie on the light cone. That's precisely what this delta function is doing. It's precisely choosing the light cone. Nothing what is actually here or here will never reach this observer at the time T and R. Okay, so that's the beauty of electromagnetism. Of course, I have, well, this light cone is really a light cone, so everything on the light cone can, in principle, contribute, but nothing else. Okay, so it's these charges here, which can affect my field at R and T. Of course, if I am at later time, then there will be these charges here, the distribution of the charges there. And that's why it is called retarded potentials. Are there any questions to this? And of course, you know, the distance between the, let's say I choose, if I had only one charge, then I would just have one concrete trajectory of the charge. And of course, it could contribute to my R&T only at this point. And so this is precisely the distance, which is R minus R prime, magnitude of that. So it's our capital R here. And this is the time T minus T prime. Okay, so that's why these are called retarded charges. If you consider the advanced solutions, of course, the future light solutions would contribute. So actually, at this point, you would have also contributions from the charges when they are actually to the future. Okay, so but we disregard these solutions based on the experience, basically. We don't observe these things. All right, so the last thing I want to discuss about this is precisely, what if I have only one charge here, not the whole distribution of charges? So then you can actually write these down more explicitly. And these are something important, and they are called Lennard-Weikert potentials. Okay, so finally, so let's consider one charge. This is called Lennard-Weikert potentials. Who have seen these? Half of you, at least. Okay, so it's really the potentials produced by a single charge particle. So consider single charge particle. And the aim is to calculate what these retarded potentials are. And so, okay. And I'm not doing this just for the sake of doing this, but it will be your first research problem in relativity course to actually calculate some of these Lennard-Weikert potentials and some of the fields of a particle in a gravitational field.
What?
I mean the homework.
That would be homework.
That would be a homework, Oh. Yes. All right. So, of course, if I have a single charge particle, this single charge particle just sweeps a trajectory which I can parameterize as x of t prime. And so this is really, you know, xi of t prime. So and then you know what these sources, what this charge density and what the current is. So charge density is simply e times the delta function of x minus r prime. And current will be just multiplied by the velocity of the particle. OK, so in this case, we have rho r prime t prime to be e delta 3 function of r prime x minus t prime, right? So the particle, so in principle, you know, this is all possible sources, but of course, this is only when the particle is actually there. So it's x minus x of t prime. And the current is the same thing. But the current is charge density times the velocity of the particle. So it's dx over dt prime, delta 3 r prime minus x t prime. OK, so in this case, the charge density and the current are so simple. So really out of these all possible r primes, I just choose the one which coincides with my x of t prime. Okay, so this is that. And so now we want to plug this into our solution. So let's just do it for phi, and then of course the same thing will apply for the vector potential A. And so interestingly, it's simpler, a little bit simpler to use it when we still haven't integrated over t prime. Okay, so let's use this formula instead of this one, although they are trivially related. So using this formula here, we have that phi rt is a delta function of r minus t prime divided by r. And then I plug this one here. So it's e, and there is another delta function, 3 r prime minus x of t prime dr prime dt prime. Okay, so that's the formula I want to use. And of course, you see immediately the advantage. So I can basically choose which delta function I want to do first. So which, if I want to kill the integration over t prime or integration over r prime. So we have seen that because of the form of the Green's function, we can always do the integration over T prime. But in this case, it's actually simple to do, or advantageous to do the integration to kill R prime integral first. So I will first use this delta function. And that simply plugs everywhere I see R prime, you will get x of T prime. All right. So then our phi just becomes delta. Okay, so let's just write it explicitly. So R is R minus R prime. So it's R, but R prime becomes x of T prime. X of T prime, so that's S minus T plus T prime. And then here is R minus x of T prime. And then we have E, and then we have dt prime. So we have done the we have used our delta function in the r prime direction. And so this is how we simplified our life. So now, did Dan do delta functions? Is he finished with them? So in particular, did you see a formula? So if you have, so this thing here, so we want to do the integration over T prime. But this thing here is a delta function over T prime, but there's some complicated function of T prime here, right? So T prime depends, well, x depends on T prime, but there's also T prime here. So this is some complicated function of T prime, okay? So now there's a beautiful formula which tells you if I have a function, delta of function of something, and this is simply given by a sum over all possible roots I, so that you take delta of t prime minus ti divided by f prime at ti, where ti are precisely the roots of the function f of t. So f of ti is equal to 0. Have you seen this formula in Dan's course?
Yes.
You have. Perfect. Then it's amazing. So really, I can get rid of this complicated function in the delta thing by just doing by summing over all possible roots ti of this function f of t prime. All right. So in other words, what I am trying to find is that only such t prime will contribute so that this thing actually can be 0, okay? But this thing can be 0 only on the light cone, right? That's what we discussed here. This is retarded potential afterwards, after all. So, you know, only those t primes which are on the past light cone can contribute. But now we have just single particle. And so there is only one single t prime which can contribute, which is this one here, okay? So in our case, in case of point particle, there's only one ti, which is precisely the retarded time as you see it here, precisely this time, t prime here. So ti, let's call it tr, retarded time. And it's t minus r minus x of tr. Okay, well, it has to be. So tr is when this guy equals to that guy because of the speed of propagation c. Okay, so that's precisely one such point.
Can you re-explain the drawing to see it clear? I'm not seeing it.
Sorry, can I what?
Can you re-explain the drawing?
All right. So let me just draw it again, maybe. So in the case of the particle, what you are interested in really is the field at point r and t. Okay, so I fixed an observer at some given r and t. This is my observer, and this is my fixed t and r. Okay, so now I'm interested in, you know, what type of fields can exist at this point. And the statement is because of the finite propagation of the signal, it has to be those which are on the past light call. Okay, so in principle, it can be any points which are to the past light cone where I'm taking the speed of light equal to 1. Okay, so it has to be points which are here. So now, of course, what is the motion of the particle? The motion of the particle is simply a trajectory in T and R plane. Okay, so the particle will sort of sweep some kind of trajectory like this, and that will be x of t prime. That's the trajectory of the particle. So now you see that the trajectory of the particle intersects the past light cone at most in one point. Okay? So that's the point where it intersects the past light cone. And of course, this happens at t prime, which is precisely such that this distance is the same as that distance. So what is this distance? So this distance, okay, so this happens at r prime and t prime. And these are such that this distance, which is r prime minus r, is the same as that distance, which is t minus t prime. Okay? So in other words, I know that this happens only for one special t prime, which now I call t retarded, but it's just, you know, just choosing, it's the same thing. And it's given by, what I was writing here. It's t minus r minus x of t retarded, which is precisely saying that t minus t prime is r. So this distance is equal to that distance. That's what this expression is. Everybody happy?
And why it has to be in that way? Why they have to be equal?
Because of c is equal to 1. So what really stands here is that, you know, c times t minus t prime. So it's the time interval times c. And that's the characteristic of the light cone, right? So the light cone propagates, 45 degrees. And so I basically make the same distance in the time direction as the same distance in the x direction, right? Very good. So now I have basically, so what it means is that I have only one Ti here, which actually contributes to the sum, which is the T retarded.
What would happen if we had a charged particle traveling at the speed of light?
Okay, no. So if you had some, okay, so I haven't told you, I will tell you in a minute, but it is an experience of life that particles, the massive particles, can travel only, you know, below the speed of light. So that's why they always have to travel more in time than they travel in space. They are slower than light. Okay, and so then this will be true. Of course, if you had some weird particles which could for some time travel faster than light and for some other time travel slower than light and whatever, you could have many more intersections. Your trajectory could look very strange, and then you could have many more intersections. But you know, it's an experience of life that the massive particles travel slower than light. Does it answer your question? All right, so we are almost done. So what it means is that our delta function of t prime is simply just delta t prime minus tr divided by f prime at tr. Okay, so let me continue the expression, but I know what f is. So our function f, is just whatever I was writing here. This thing here. That's our function f. So it's f is and so how do I want to write it? That's fine. So f is t prime minus t and then plus r minus x of t prime. Okay, so that's our f. So in other words, delta of f of t prime is, well, okay, so it's delta of t prime minus t retarded divided, and now I have to differentiate this respect to t prime. Okay, so what is f prime? Okay, so I differentiate this respect to t prime. So this is 1. t is a different thing. It's constant. This is the t prime, so this is gone. And then I have to differentiate this magnitude r minus x of t prime. So magnitude is vector times vector square root of that. Okay, so if I differentiate that, I get a square root at the bottom. And okay, so I'll just write down the result. So the statement is that this is equal to r minus x of r, okay, sorry, t prime, times dx over dt prime divided by the magnitude r of x of t prime. So what I'm using is that the magnitude of x is square root of x times x. So if I differentiate this, it's 1/2. So if I differentiate this, it's square root of x times x, which is this thing here. And then I, of course, have to differentiate x. So it'll be x times dx over dt. And so this is what I'm writing here. All right, so, and that's it. So I use this formula here, plug it into this expression here. So there will be 1 minus r minus x of r, these are vectors, times the corresponding velocity, dx over dt at r, and then divided by magnitude r minus x of tr. And so if I write it this way, then I can do the integration over dt prime. So now I have a delta function, which is a simple t prime minus tr. So everywhere I see t prime, I just plug tr. Okay. What have I done here?
Why is it a minus?
Why is it a minus? Yeah. Because you have a minus sign here. So if it's also. So I differentiate this guy here, but this guy has in front of it minus sign. And that's the origin of this minus sign here. Okay, something strange here, but let's write the result. And let's write it correctly. So then I can do this delta function over t prime, and I have a simple result, which is that phi of r of t is simply e divided by r minus x of tr, and then minus v of tr times r minus x of tr. Now I'm writing vectors so that you are not so confused. And so basically, you can calculate this potential as long as you know how the trajectory of the particle looked at this retarded time, precisely at the time when the line cone could cross it, and then if you know the velocity of the particle at the time. Okay, so given the position and velocity of the particle at the retarded time, I know what my potential looks like later on. And of course, if I wanted A, the only difference is that now A has this extra velocity factor here. So if I wanted A vector potential, there will be an extra velocity here at tr. So that would be an extra velocity here at tr if I wanted the vector potential A. Okay, so your task in your relativity homework will be to take this solution, which is written in this form, write it in a relativistic form, and then use it to calculate the fields of a charge in a gravitational field. Okay, that will be your first homework. Interesting problem. And hopefully you will produce some nice pictures how the field of this charge looks like. And you would be surprised is that, of course, in the vicinity of the charge, you would expect that that charge is too small and the gravitational field not important. So you would expect, actually, if the field is uniform, that maybe you have something like Coulomb law. Okay, and that's actually true. So close to the charge, you have a Coulomb law. But further and further away you go from the charge, the field is distorted more and more, and then you will find something completely different. Okay, so that's that will be your relativity homework one, to calculate the fields of the charge. Questions? Alrighty, so now let me go to some boring stuff, but we have to do it. So I told you that in 1860 we had this Maxwell's theory, which is incompatible with Newtonian theory. So, and that it immediately leads to special relativity. So let's see how that goes. So before we go there, let's say, let me mention some, so from Maxwell, that will be part C, from Maxwell to special relativity. And before I go there, let me mention some symmetries of Maxwell's theory. So symmetries of Maxwell's theory. And why I do that is that really to convince you that Maxwell's theory is really the cornerstone of modern physics. So first of all, we already know it's a gauge theory. It's a gauge theory. So every modern theory is a gauge theory. So that's good. And you know, if you think about it this way, so in gauge theories, you always choose to overdo your description, right? So you choose for your description phi and a fields, but you know that there is some extra gauge freedom. So they, you know that that if you want the 2 degrees of freedom, you have to do some gauge fixing. You have to you know, kill some of the components of the phi and a. But you do it anyway because the description in terms of phi and a is super beautiful. If you start gauge fixing, then you get rid of your freedom, but typically it's super ugly. Okay, so in gauge theories, the idea is that really I overdo the description so that it's nice and beautiful, but I have an extra gauge freedom then. And if, once I start gauge fixing for concrete calculation or whatever, then actually it becomes super ugly. Okay, so that's the idea for gauge theories. Of course, it is relativistic. Whereas we will have to do some work to actually elevate Newtonian mechanics to relativistic mechanics. We don't have to do any work for Maxwell's theory. It's already relativistic. Everything which I'm writing here is actually already relativistic. No changes will be there due to special relativity. And the only art is actually to write all these equations in a relativistic form. Okay, but everything will remain exactly the same. It is a conformal theory. Conformal theory. That means it's only true in 4D. So there's something special about four dimensions, at least for Maxwell's theory. In fact, in higher dimensions, Maxwell's theory is super ugly because it loses the conformal symmetry. So what I mean by conformal symmetry is that you can rescale the metric and you will see that basically your equations remain invariant if you do that. Finally, there is this electromagnetic duality, which is another kind of interesting symmetry. So if you have sources which are switched off, so in the absence of sources, you can do a transformation E to B and B to minus E. And you'll see that your Maxwell equations remain invariant under this. So I can actually sort of rotate electric fields to magnetic ones and magnetic fields to electric ones, and they'll still be the same equations of motion. So this is quite interesting symmetry. You can generalize this a lot. And you know, it's an interesting part of symmetry. So now, in the following, let me concentrate on this type of symmetry. Let me show you that actually, really, Maxwell's theory is relativistic. Okay. So to do that, the first step which we can do is that we have a finite speed of propagation, c. We predicted the speed of light. And so once we have that, we can now unify time coordinate with the space coordinate. Okay, so having predicted the universal speed, of light, c, in our case, this is equal to 1. I'll write it in the first thing, and then I'll probably forget it many times. But you can always convert things by putting the c's back. We can now unify space and time into space-time, so x and t into space-time. And of course, this is seems super formidable statement, but all you are doing is that basically you notice that I can multiply t with the velocity c. I get something which is dimensions of length. And so now I can really treat ct as a new length coordinate. Okay, so then we can have space-time coordinates, x mu, which are ct, and then xi. So these will be the space-time coordinates. And these will be the spatial coordinates. And so I will have a convention that I will start with 0, I think. Well, Landau's book still uses 4. But so in this course and in the later courses, mu is the Greek, so Greek indices will run from 0 to 3, and they are the space-time indices. And Latin indices will run from 1 to 3, and these are the spatial indices. And the space-time, and this is the spatial. And of course, as Neil Turok says, you know, this is the ultimate proof that ancient Greeks were more clever than the ancient Romans. Okay? The ancient Greeks, they already knew about space-time, whereas Romans lived only in the 3D space. Okay? So ultimate proof of this. All right, so we have the coordinates. And of course, now we can extend this definition into everything. So in particular, we can, for example, extend the derivatives. Okay, so similarly, combine derivatives. So for example, I'll be writing d mu, which I mean d over dx mu, and that will be d over c dt and d over dxi. Okay, so you combine time derivatives with the spatial derivatives to have space-time derivatives. Okay, another step which Einstein at the beginning very much objected to is the introduction of a space-time metric. And so when Minkowski introduced this metric, Einstein was very upset that he says, this just obscures my beautiful physical ideas. But of course, then he realized later on that that's precisely the step forward. That's what he needs to formulate actually general relativity. So anyway, so then we can introduce a matrix, eta, alpha, beta, which will be just minus 1, 1, 1, 1, and 0 everywhere, else, and then its inverse, eta, alpha, beta, which is the same thing, minus 1, 1, 1, 1 on the diagonal, and 0 everywhere else. Why I'm saying that this is inverse is that if you multiply these two matrices, you indeed get 1, so eta, alpha, beta, eta, beta, gamma, is delta gamma alpha. Okay, this is just a unit matrix in four dimensions. Okay, so we have, okay, so here I'm probably setting c equal to 1 already. Let's set c equal to 1 unless specify otherwise. Okay, so that's our two matrices. And we shall, so by the way, there's lots of conventions here. So people coming from high energy physics, they would typically write plus 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. So they would swap the signature of this matrix here. People coming from general relativity, they typically tend to have minus for the time direction. So that's, you know, only in the 0, 0 component. The biggest surprise for me was when Zwiebach was lecturing string theory here a couple of years back. And so he comes from the high energy physics community, of course. And so then when he started writing eta alpha beta and he wrote minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, then I was super, super happy about that. And then I was happy until he wrote then that ds square is minus eta alpha beta dx alpha. Which really got me. All right. So we have this convention here, and I'll be using this one in relativity course. But then, if you take Ruth's Gregory course about gravitational physics later on after Christmas, and she uses the opposite signature, which is a disaster. All right, so so we can use these matrices. So can use the lower and rise indices. Just take that as a definition. So the statement is that we can have two types of objects. We can have vectors, and then we can have covectors. And so in principle, these objects, they live in different spaces. But if you have the metric, then you don't really have to care because you can transform one to another. So for example, I can get omega mu by simply rising the index with in terms of the matrix with indices upstairs, omega eta mu nu, omega nu. And similarly, I can get a covector out of V by doing eta mu nu V nu. Okay? So you can really relate one to another by using this matrix eta. Okay, so what does this amount to? In special relativity is super simple. So let's say my V mu vector has components, so it's Vt, V0, and then Vi. So now if I lower the index, V mu, so then, okay, so this is the prescription, so it's eta mu nu, V nu. But this is just a diagonal matrix, which has, however, minus sign in the zero component. And that's why I pick up a minus here. So it will be minus V0 and then Vi. So this is as simple as putting a minus sign in the first slot. So notice also that I can use this matrix to write my box operator, of the box operator can be either written as eta alpha beta, d alpha, d beta. So what is this? Is this minus d over dt square plus d over dx square. Or you can also write it this way, doesn't really matter, d beta. But all it is just minus dt square plus sum over I d square xi. Okay, so this is the box operator, but you can write it in such a nice way here. Questions to this? You seem super unhappy.
Sorry.
Okay. All right, so we have that. So now our next step is to really rewrite all these equations here in the relativistic notation. And once we can write it in terms of the vectors and stuff like that, they will be automatically special relativistic because the vectors will transform nicely under Lorentz transformations and so on. Okay, so now we want to do the electromagnetism. In relativistic form. So basically the statement is, if we can write all these equations in terms of vectors and whatever vector equations, they already be special relativistic. They will already be invariant under Lorentz transformations. All right, so the simplest way how to start is to actually look at the potentials. So we have the potential phi and a. So it's one phi, and then it's three a's, ax, ay, az. They naturally form a vector. Okay, so the first step, which is of course based on counting, is very natural to introduce the potential, which is simply phi and a here. Okay, so as the first step, we combine the four potentials into a vector a mu. So then the next step would be, well, let's look at the Lorentz gauge condition. So then the Lorentz gauge condition. So what it is just d phi over dt plus a divergence of a, okay? So it contains some derivatives. It contains third derivatives with respect to time and with respect to space of this A. Okay, so natural guess would be that this is just d mu A mu equals to zero. Well, is it? So d mu, where is it? D mu is one just d over dt of AT, which is phi. So d phi over dt, and then you have plus di of ai, but ai is just a vector potential I, so this is precisely the Lorentz gauge condition. Okay, so this is the Lorentz gauge condition in the relativistic notation. So beautiful thing is that you can basically guess everything, right? So you just need to know that the Lorentz gauge condition is linear in A. It's just a scalar function, so there cannot be any free index. It contains one derivative of these things, and this is what it has to be. Okay. So we have the Lorentz gauge condition. So now I can look at how my A mu with index down looks like. And so what I was trying to convince you is that because of this minus sign, there's just, you know, this minus coming from here, so it'll be minus phi and a. So the next step would be to look at the gauge transformations. So we know that the gauge transformations, I can go from phi to a time derivative of lambda, and then from a to spatial derivative of some function lambda. Okay, so now it's natural to go from a mu to a mu plus d mu of lambda. So let's see if it works. So for example, let's take the zero component. So we have minus phi goes to minus phi plus dt of lambda. So in other words, phi goes to phi minus dt of lambda. which is precisely that. And the spatial part, there's no minuses, no funny business, it's minus signs. So then this will be just that, okay? So this is the Lorentz gauge condition. And this is the corresponding gauge transformation. Okay, so now the next thing about the potentials was that we want to write down these equations here. Well, box is already relativistic. And we combine phi and a to a mu. So the left-hand side will be just box on a mu equals to the sources. So now you see that I can combine the sources into a four vector where my four vector current will be just rho and j. Okay, so introducing further, using the four vector current j mu to be rho and j. So I'm combining the charge density with the current. I see that my wave equations are simply written as box on a mu equals to minus 4 pi j mu. These are my wave equations, which we derived over there. Then we had a solution in terms of these retarded potentials here. And again, I just combined the solution into a mu on the left-hand side. And this I combine into j. So the retarded potentials, the solutions of these, are simply that a mu is d3r prime j mu t minus r prime divided by r minus r prime. Okay, and that's the retarded solution for both potentials now written in the four vector notation. Combines these two equations here. Okay, so now I could do the same thing for the linear Vicot potentials, but it will be your task in the homework, so I will leave it here. And you can already speculate what it could be. Okay? Very good. So we have transformed everything about the potential. So all this blackboard here is just basically written in these four beautiful equations in these blackboards. Okay, so now let's consider. So of course, you know, so why? So this is nice. So we wrote these equations as vector equations. So these vector equations better be invariant under something. So what this something is of course Lorentz transformations. So let's discuss Lorentz transformations. Lorentz transformations. So we'll return back to them in relativity course briefly, but only very briefly. So okay, so what this is that I can transform my coordinates x mu into some new coordinates, x mu prime. Okay, and so the Lorentz transformations are the only guaranteed to be non-singular transformations. If you want to do transformations of coordinates, they typically encounter some singularity somewhere, unless the transformation is linear. If the transformation is linear, then you are guaranteed that there won't be any singularities anywhere. Okay, so we want a linear transformation. That's why we do just a multiplication by a matrix lambda. By this matrix lambda are some constants. So this is a linear transformation. Okay. This is a constant matrix. Constant 4x4 matrix. And of course, it better be non-singular, because otherwise, even if it's linear, it can be still screwed up, right? So this is a constant non-singular 4x4 matrix. Okay. If it's non-singular, I can invert it. Okay, so by inversion, I can go from the other way around. So x mu prime goes to x mu, which is some new matrix lambda mu nu x nu. So x mu prime are my new coordinates. So these are the new coordinates. These are the old ones. And this is an inverse matrix. So lambda and lambda tilde are inverse. So what that means is that lambda mu nu lambda tilde nu kappa is delta mu kappa. So I'm summing over the index this one. But of course, I can also sum over this index. And because if you have matrices, it doesn't matter. So if you have operators, you can have inverse, one inverse when you sum over these indices, and you can have another inverse if you sum over those indices. But in a finite dimensional space, this is not true, and the inverses are the same. So I can always, for matrices, this will also be true. Lambda mu nu, lambda nu, alpha mu is delta alpha nu. It's guaranteed just from this relation here. If you have infinite dimensional vector space, it's not true. But if you have finite dimensional one, it's true. So really, lambda and lambda tilde are inverse matrices. Okay. So now we know how the coordinates transform. So let's look at how the other objects transform. And so one object which can transform is the derivative. So let's look at the derivative, d mu prime. What I mean by that is d over dx prime mu. So now my x prime mu depends on x nu, so I can use the chain rule. And this will be dx nu over dx prime mu, d over dx nu. Okay, but now what is dx nu over dx prime mu? So what is this guy here? So if you look at the definitions here, okay. Oh no. So I need to differentiate this type of relation with respect to, oh, there's a prime missing. Nobody told me. You have one big minus. Okay, so there must be a prime coordinates here, of course. Prime. Okay, so I get that by a lambda tilde. So this thing is lambda tilde, nu, and mu. Okay, so the derivatives transform according to lambda tilde. And then more generally, I will say that any object which sort of you see an index down will transform in terms of the lambda tilde. Okay. So what is it I'm writing here? So any object with index down transforms according to this. That means omega mu prime is lambda tilde nu mu omega mu. Okay, so this is how covectors transforms. So that's a covector. And then I'll be cheating here and I will say that everything which transforms as coordinates is a vector. Okay? So this is one big fat lie, because the coordinates are not a vector. Okay, so coordinates are simply coordinates, and they don't transform. You can so in special relativity, and if you consider Lorentz transformations, they do transform under Lorentz transformations this way. But in general relativity, you can do any transformation of coordinates, Okay, and that's not how vectors transform. And so in general relativity, coordinates will not be a vector, and it's better not to think about coordinates as vector in special relativity as well. But anyway, so vectors transform in this way. They transform according to lambda. V nu prime, and this will be a vector. And in the study text, I have a different. So I show that A, okay, let's show it. So the question is A mu a vector? Well, it better be. But if it is a vector, and if d mu is a covector, then this must be a scalar. D mu a mu, is it a scalar? So if it is a scalar, we know that this is a covector, so this must be a vector. And then you can really play with these things. So you can write, you know, how this looks like with primes. So d prime mu over a prime mu. And so then you transform this guy according to lambda tilde. So it's lambda tilde nu mu d nu. And if a mu were a vector, it would transform this way. So we would have lambda mu alpha a alpha. So here we assume it is a vector. And if that is true, then we would have lambda tilde meets lambda, and they are summed over mu, and they give you a delta function. And so you would really find that this is d alpha a alpha. So demanding that d mu a mu is a scalar, you find that a mu really has to transform as a vector, which is proved here. So scalar is something which does not transform, so it has to have the same value everywhere. Okay. Are there any questions about this? Who hasn't seen this? Everybody's seen this, right? This is just,
Well, I mean, I'm an undergrad, so.
Okay. All right. So the final step is to actually tell you what these Lorentz transformations are. And for that, let me just use the fact that I want that my box operator, well, that my wave equation is valid in any coordinate system. So demanding that the wave operator preserves its form under Lorentz transformation . Okay, so what is it I demand? So I have the formula that box is eta alpha beta d alpha d beta. Okay, so that's in one coordinate system. So now if I change to another coordinate system, I just put primes everywhere. So it will be eta, and I can, one thing I didn't say. But you did an object, so it's probably fine. So if you sum over, so wherever you see two indices the same, you sum over them. That's the Einstein summation convention. And you call the index you sum over the dummy index. Have you seen that? So these are the dummy indices because they are summed over, and I can rename them to anything. So I can equally write mu and mu here, but I can write alpha and alpha. It doesn't matter because it's sum over. It's just telling you I'm summing over this index. On the other hand, if you have some free index, meaning that it stands on its own, it's the real index. And you have to, whatever is on the left-hand side is that free index, has to be on the right-hand side of your equation with that free index. Okay, so we have eta mu nu d mu d mu prime. This is just a how it looks like in the new frame. But now I demand that it looks exactly, that it preserves the form. So if it's written in these type of coordinates as minus dt square plus nabla square, it better be written in the new coordinates as minus dt prime square plus nabla prime square. Okay, that's the form invariant which you demand. Okay, so in other words, okay, so I have the new derivatives here, which are here, but the matrix eta mu nu cannot change. So it cannot suddenly become from minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 to something like cosine theta, sine theta, and whatever, because then, of course, I would have cosine theta here and sine theta here and stuff like that. Okay, so what I demand, so invariance in form, invariance in form, means that this has to be equal to eta mu nu d prime nu. Okay, so this is what you demand, is that the box operator looks the same under Lorentz transformation. Okay, of course, what this means is that now I can use the transformation rule, which I already established. So I have eta mu nu, and for this thing here, I know that the derivatives transform as vector here, so it'll be lambda, mu alpha lambda nu beta d alpha d beta. So that's the transformation rule. And so you see that this better be equal to that. So I'm finding a relation that this thing here has to be eta alpha beta. And that's a beautiful equation. And if you want, it's a definition of Lorentz transformation. So this will be lambda nu beta eta mu nu lambda mu alpha. This thing here has to be satisfied in order the box operator to be invariant in form, and this is precisely the definition of the Lorentz transformation.
The dt prime should be squared too, right?
Sorry, what?
The dt prime in the...
Yeah. Thank you. Of course. Thanks. Okay, so this is the definition of the Lorentz transformation. Any transformation, any matrix lambda, which satisfies this kind of equation will be a Lorentz transformation. Okay? And of course, this will be true for rotations, which don't do anything with time, but only touch the spatial coordinates and rotate the spatial coordinates. This will be true for the boosts, which basically rotate the space and time coordinate in one direction. But it will also be true for some other Lorentz transformations. Okay, so you can schematically write this as eta equals to lambda transpose eta lambda. And why I'm doing this is that you can take a determinant of both sides. And do you know what determinant of eta is? Sorry?
One.
Almost?
Minus one.
Minus one, perfect. So it's minus one, plus one, plus one, plus one on the diagonal. So minus one. But then you know that the determinant of a product of matrices is product of determinants. Okay? So then this has to be equal to determinant of lambda t, determinant of lambda, determinant of eta, which is minus one. Okay, but then if you know the determinant of lambda, what is the determinant of lambda t? It's the same. So this is just determinant of lambda square, determinant of lambda square. And so then you are finding that in, you know, Lorentz transformations have to be such that determinant of lambda square is equal to plus 1, which means determinant of lambda is either plus 1 or it's minus 1. And so those Lorentz transformations which have determinant equal to plus 1, they can typically be, okay, so these are called proper Lorentz transformations, and these are not proper. And you know, this will include things like time inversion and space inversion and stuff like that.
In general, does it matter the order that you write the terms in a product?
Okay. So you have matrices, so in general it matters how you write.
Right, but you switch the order.
So here I'm writing everything in components, so it doesn't really matter. Okay. Right? So this is just a number. This is just one component of the matrix, and so this here it doesn't matter. If I write it this way as a matrix multiplication, then it matters.
Right. How do you know that it's this order?
Oh, so you see, well, maybe I wrote it mu nu. So this is symmetric. So you see that I'm multiplying eta with lambda. So you are summing over the nearby index. Okay. So that's why you have eta lambda. And then if you transpose this, you would be summing over beta and nu, but now transposed, this will be the index close by. So that's why I'm transposing the matrix to have the index here. And yeah. Well, this is so bad, right? So nobody writes this. So just live with this, and then everything is clear. You know which index you sum over, and you know it doesn't matter how you write it, because you're just summing over indices, right? So this is just people like to work with matrices, which is a bad habit, but anyway. So this is certainly much better. All right. So we have established what Lorentz transformations are. They are simply any linear transformation where the matrix lambda satisfies this. And you know, they can either be such that the determinant lambda is plus 1, in which case these are the proper Lorentz transformations, or it's minus 1, and these are something weird. Okay. So now we know what Lorentz transformations are. So the last step in our program is to basically rewrite the Maxwell equations. So we have already rewritten this in a relativistic form. So now the last step is to look at that in the relativistic form. So let's do it here. And again, you can sort of guess the result. So now we want Maxwell equations. In relativistic form. So what this could be, right? So we have E and B. Okay, so now we have to combine these field strengths E and B, and there is 6 of those. Okay. There's 6 of them. You have to combine them into some vector or something else. Okay, so can it be a vector? Can we combine them into a vector? Not really. Vector has only 4 components, right? Whereas here we have 6. Okay, so that's not a good thing. But we know that these E and Bs actually are given by some kind of derivative on the vector potential. Okay, so and the derivative is always like, it's a linear thing. So we have only one derivative acting on phi and a. Okay, so good guess could be that maybe, you know, we can combine them into a derivative of a vector potential. Okay. However, this thing here, how many components does it have?
Four.
Sorry. This one has four. This one has four.
Okay.
So 16. All right. So this object would have 16 components. So that's too many. Okay. So this is not the right guess. It's almost the right guess. So now, fortunately, you can split any object, any tensor with two indices, into its symmetric and antisymmetric parts. So you can symmetrize over that, g mu a nu. So by definition, this is 1 half d mu a nu plus d nu a mu. Or into its antisymmetric part. So, okay, which is by definition 1 half. Am I missing something here? D mu, oh no! D. Sorry for that. Another try. Okay, D mu A nu, which is by definition 1 half D mu A nu minus D nu A mu. Okay, so I'll be using these brackets to symmetrize or antisymmetrize indices. Whenever you see normal bracket, it means symmetrization over the indices inside. So symmetrization means like divide by 1 over something, and then I do all the permutations of the indices so that it's symmetric, and I do plus everywhere. And then if it's antisymmetrization, I just even permutations come with plus, and on odd permutations comes with minus sign. Okay, so but in this case, it's just two indices, so this is what it is. And you can indeed check that if I sum this plus that, then this term cancels, and I recover back this thing here. So now, how many components a symmetric object with two indices has?
10.
Very good. So this object would have 10 components. And of course, by default, then this is must have 16 minus 10, which is 6. 6 components. Aha! I needed 6 components for E and B. Now I found a way how to find 6 components out of this tensor. And so this must be the right prescription. Okay, so then it's almost true except the factor 1 half. So then you define a field strength tensor for Maxwell's theory is just d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. This will have 6 non-trivial components. Each of them are linear in derivatives of a vector potential. There's nothing else you can write down which has 6 components. And so they better be related to into E and B. And if you look at what this gives you, this is indeed so. So now you have a 4x4 matrix, which is antisymmetric. So it has to have zeros on the diagonal. And then here you will find that this is minus EX, minus EY, minus EZ. There's a zero here. And then you will have BZ minus BY and BX. And then you have 0, 0 here. And it's antisymmetric, so you will have the antisymmetric minus parts of this. This is what you find. All right, so we managed to combine field strengths into a Lorentz object, which has now two indices, but it's antisymmetric. That's why it has these 6 components. All right. So that's great. So now we have a tensor. By the way, you can write the indices. You can write it with f mu nu up. And if you write these indices using the eta, then the only thing is that the time direction components will change sign. So this will now suddenly become plus EX plus EY plus EZ. But the spatial components don't do anything. So we will have still BZ minus BY BX. Okay. So now let's check that the gauge transformations do not change this field strength. The gauge transformation. Gauge transformation. So we know that the gauge transformation is going from A mu plus D mu of lambda. And we, of course, demanded that this leaves the field strength, the ENB invariant. So, okay, so what happens with FB nu? FB nu now goes to F mu nu. Okay, it goes to, okay, what does it go to? It's D mu A nu plus d nu lambda, which is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu plus d mu of lambda. Now very good. So now it's d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, which is the original f mu nu. And then you have d nu lambda minus d nu d mu lambda. You switch the order of partial derivatives and you get zero. So indeed, the field strength remains invariant under this gauge transformation. All right. So that's good. So we have really the field strength. It remains invariant under gauge transformations. It combines in E and B's together. Last step is to write down the Maxwell's equations and to write the Lorentz force law.
Why is the second term zero?
So the second term is just, so you have d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, that gives you f mu nu, right? And then you have a term which you have d mu d nu on lambda, but then you have minus d nu d mu on lambda.
Okay.
D mu d nu lambda minus d nu d mu lambda, you are in physics. You can swap the order of partial derivatives, and it's zero. Okay? All right. So now we split these Maxwell equations into those with sources and those without sources. And we know that those with without sources should be better automatically satisfied if you choose E and B to write in terms of the potentials. Right, that's what we have done. So choosing this thing here automatically solved 2 and 4. So we better make sure that 2 and 4 are satisfied, provided we chose to write f mu nu in terms of d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. And it's a simple exercise to show that you can write it in this form. So the sourceless equations 2 and 4, the statement is you can write them as f mu nu lambda cyclic equal to 0 or just f mu nu lambda antisymmetrization over all three indices equal to 0, doesn't matter. So what I mean by cyclic is that you just cyclically permutate the three indices. So it's f mu nu lambda plus f lambda mu nu plus f nu lambda mu. That's what cyclic means. So if you want, you can show that this equals to that, apart from some factor. Of course, this thing is that I'm doing complete antisymmetrization. So I will, and I have three indices, so I'll have six terms. But the statement is, we know that f mu nu is antisymmetric by definition. And if you use this antisymmetry of f mu nu, you can always combine two terms into one. So then you will have these six terms, but they combine into three terms, and these are precisely the three terms. Simple exercise. All right, so then the statement is, if this, so, So this is the Maxwell equation 2 and 4. Okay, you can check that explicitly. Does it give me 2 and 4? And you should maybe enough to convince yourself that once I set f mu nu to be d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, this will be true. Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm choosing this thing here. So plug that for f mu nu here and check that this is automatically satisfied. Okay?
What is the third index?
I put lambda here.
Yeah, what
is that? Okay, very good. So f mu nu is your field strength.
Yeah.
Okay, so thanks that you asked. So now I switch to another notation where this comma here means a partial derivative. Okay, so what's written, thank you so much for that question. That's good. So then what this means is that you take f mu nu and you differentiate that with respect to x lambda. And so I'll be using notation like that. Yeah, you know, that's why we are doing this here, so that we are all on the same page about the notation and stuff like that. Okay, so then finally you need those equations with sources. Okay, those equations with sources in the simplest case is just divergence of E is rho. Okay, so now we replace E with f mu nu, and we replace rho with j nu. Okay, so then it's obvious that this equation simply generalizes into a spacetime divergence. So we'll have d mu f mu nu equals to minus 4 pi j nu. Okay, so that's how the source full equations look like, and it's obvious from the equation 3. Okay, the equation 3 plus the equation 1. Let me just do the counting that it's possible. Of course, I'm summing over this index mu here. So the only free index is the index nu. So it's 4 equations. And so 1 and 3 are, of course, 4 equations. So it works. All right. There is another cunning way how to write this equation here. And so this looks quite ugly, right? So I have three indices here. I have to do cyclic permutation of this. So this is much nicer. It's just obviously four equations. This is also four equations, but it just looks more ugly. Okay, so there is another way how you can write the first equation, and it's in terms of the Hodge duality. So now we have two sets of equations. So let's say A, well, this is not good. A and B, we have A and B equations. So to write A more nicely, we will introduce a Hodge duality. So a Hodge star of F mu nu. So f is the field strength, but now this will be some new object, Hodge star of f, is given in terms of 1 half epsilon mu nu kappa lambda f kappa lambda. So this is our original field strength. And this thing here is the Levi-Civita pseudotensor. Which you know in three dimensions, you know epsilon ijk, which is either plus 1 or minus 1 or 0, depending on the permutation of indices. So this is the same object, but now the indices run from 0 to 4. So namely, epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3, 0 to 3 is equal to plus 1. And the even permutations will be equal to plus 1. But if I swap these things, epsilon 0, 1, 0, 2, 3 is equals to minus 1. And if you have two indices the same or more, then it's 0. Okay, so this is the Levi-Civita tensor. So anyway, this is just a definition. So we define a new object, star of f. And of course, you sum over these dummy indices, kappa and lambda here. And if you do that, then I can look at this equation here. Of course, this object is completely anti-symmetric. So whenever I swap two indices, I pick up a minus sign. Okay, so then I can take this equation A and multiply it by this object epsilon. So then I will have epsilon mu, what is it? I want epsilon alpha mu nu lambda. I put 1/2 here, and then I take this equation here. That's f mu nu lambda. And this still is equal to 0 because this guy is. Okay, so this must be true. All right, so what it means is very good. So this thing is nothing else than d of lambda f mu nu anti-symmetrization. Okay. But because I completely anti-symmetrize here, but this object is already completely anti-symmetric, I don't actually need to anti-symmetrize. Because this object already guarantees is that it will anti-symmetrize it. Is this clear? Maybe. Maybe. Okay, we can discuss this a little bit more. But so for the time being, I just can get rid of that. But remember, this object here is just a constant. It's either plus 1 or minus 1 or 0. So I can pull it through the derivative. So this will be actually written as d lambda, and then 1/2 epsilon alpha mu nu lambda f mu nu. OK, disaster. Now I can move this object here. But anyway, so what this is just star of f alpha lambda. OK, and so then you see that you can write the equation A in a much nicer form, which is simply d of lambda star of f alpha lambda equals to 0. Or I can swap the indices. I will have lambda alpha because it's still equal to 0. And you see that this equation now looks precisely as this equation here. But now I have the currents equal to 0. OK. But what this star is really doing is that as you have your matrix for f mu nu, in the zero component we have e's, and then in the spatial components we had b's. Okay, what the star is doing is it switches that. It switches e's to b's and b's to e's. So now you have b's in the upper row and e's in the lower row. Okay, so what this is really doing is doing something like divergence of b instead of divergence of e. Okay, so this in particular contains like divergence of b equals to 0 and stuff like that. Okay, so now there's a direct generalization of Maxwell's theory to include the magnetic charges. So I could go to d alpha star f alpha beta, and then I could include easily the magnetic currents here, and that would be a generalization of Maxwell's theory to include the magnetic charges. Okay, so this is how simply you can actually arrive at this generalization in this relativistic notation. Anyway, this is the right Maxwell equation. This would be the extension of Maxwell theory and to include magnetic charges. All right. So you can take this to be equation A prime, and then A prime and B are the Maxwell equations. The last thing is the Lorentz force law, which is this one. Well, OK, very good. So we have dp over dt is the force. OK, dp over dt better be a new four vector. And force is the new four vector. So instead of dp over dt, you will see that t is not good coordinate, but that is like a proper time. So dp over d tau, that's the generalization. And then what the hell the right-hand side can be, right? So e is e. Okay, and then we have something which is linear in E and B. So what contains the information about E and B is F mu nu. So then, so the right-hand side must be linear in F mu nu. So there must be F here. And then what is also on the right-hand side is the velocity of the particle. So there will be a four velocity of the particle. And it's linear in that, so it must be u. OK, but left-hand side has only one index, so I have to contract the indices mu nu, u nu. And that's it. And there can be anything else. It must be this thing here. So that's the Lorentz force law. And so we have written the whole Maxwell theory in the relativistic notation. But because it's written in relativistic notation, and it's written in terms of the vectors and stuff like that, it will be invariant under Lorentz transformations. And so it's relativistic.
That's u, right? Like the u of nu.
So this is u.
Yeah.
It's the four velocity. I will tell you what it is tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but it's like a generalization of the velocity, u. OK? Questions? So who hasn't seen this? Who hasn't seen Maxwell theory in relativistic notation? OK, that's good. So we are learning something new. And for the rest, it was just, you know, arriving at Maxwell's theory, arriving at special relativity from studying the Maxwell theory is actually, I hope, a little bit new. People typically start with relativistic mechanics, but that's actually harder because you don't know. You have to really generalize the Newtonian mechanics to the relativistic one, whereas the Maxwell theory is already relativistic, and all you have to do is to rewrite it into the relativistic notation. Okay, let's continue tomorrow.